Well, it's been a fascinating experience to be part of a universal church gathering such as this. I think the main impression that has left on me, apart from, and I will mention one or two of the individual interventions, is that the whole is bigger than the sum of its parts. So when the church is gathered here, head and the various parts of the body together, there is an energy and a strength which might not always be the case in any of the individual parts. And particularly here in Europe, I think we realise and would accept very much that there are many of our particular churches that are somewhat tired, disillusioned and frustrated. But there is an energy in the church as a whole. And of course, that's because it is the body of Christ. And that's maybe never so obvious as it is when we gather like this. I think what has struck me very forcibly is the richness of the various cultural expressions of church, and what the various gifts that these different parts of the church bring to the body as a whole. And I think I was particularly taken by the Asian church, and I have to single out Archbishop Tagle from Manila. You know, we say it's not just what you say, but the way you say it. In his case, both the content but also the tone of his engagement spoke very, very deeply, I think, to me. He talked about the need for a humbler church, a church that is silent, appropriately silent, before the complexity of many of the human issues which we find ourselves struggling with, and shows a certain level of respect before it tries to engage with people. I think that found a deep resonance in the Synod Hall, to be honest with you. And his colleague, also from the Philippines, Bishop Villegas, echoed those same sentiments. I was also taken by the very direct intervention from the Father General of the Jesuits, Father Nicola, and which he really acknowledged that the first evangelization hasn't always been, in a sense, accompanied by the certain level of humility and respect that was needed, and that, in fact, in the past, the Church did some things that certainly should not be part of the way we go about the new evangelization. And I think that was a very important point to make, that we must learn from the experiences and indeed sometimes the mistakes of our past.
But it isn't just a nodding shot. There are lively debates. There is heated discussion. Views are challenged, always, of course, under the auspices of being in communion. But at the same stage, communion doesn't mean unilateral agreement, does it?
Well, no. Communion, I think, means that there's unity and difference. It's not uniformity. And the last hour of each day has been, where we're in general session, has been reserved for what they call free intervention, in the sense of that it doesn't have to be a prepared script. It can be a response to something that was heard during the day. And this was particularly, I think, refreshing, and many people have said it, they have been the most lively moments of the day. I think of two particular issues that I found challenging. One was the issue of the right order of the sacraments of initiation. So do we have confirmation before communion or after communion? And in various parts of the church as it stands, we find that done in different ways. For example, in New Zealand, I know they do confirmation before communion in one or other of the dioceses. I think in parts of the UK and in the United States as well. Now, it seems to me this is one of the examples of where the opposite of one truth can be another truth in the church. And in fact, I found persuasive arguments were being put forward both from pastoral and from theological perspectives. So there was a lively exchange around that. The other one, I think it's well known now, is that we also have had some strong views expressed about how to engage with Islam. And of course, different churches have different experiences of Islam. Somewhere, in fact, you know, there's extraordinarily rich interaction and cooperation and interreligious dialogue. Others, where perhaps the experience is one more of alienation and oppression. So I think that has been reflected on the Synod floor. And again, I suppose, whereas in the West, we're dealing with the whole issue of secularization. For many of the Synod Fathers in countries where they're denied religious basic religious freedom, they might consider some of our discussions somewhat self-indulgent, given the physical threats and physical hardships which many of them face on a daily basis. I think of, for example, Lebanon, Syria and so on.
There's been a real wake-up call from the younger churches to the older church, hasn't there? Reading some of the interventions that have been given by leaders of the church, religious leaders, but also lay leaders actively involved in the church in Asia, in Africa, they have really had very strong words for the church in Europe and America, haven't they?
They have, and I think that again is what I mentioned earlier about this, in a sense, mutual gifting that is going on, and part of where the energy and the strength is in the body as a whole. And we know that even from our physical bodies, that sometimes when part of our physical body is in pain or injured, the rest of the body can act to heal that and strengthen that. And I think that's exactly what we're experiencing here. And maybe some of what you've described as these interventions are a form of tough love, in a sense. There's a place for that too.
Now, you've been called here as one of these experts. What are these synod experts?
I'm still trying to work that one out myself. I think it's a very refreshing and an important aspect. And with all the synods of the church, including of course the Second Vatican Council, there have always been a place for, I suppose, people with a certain scholarship and academic perspective which can be brought to bear on the questions concerned. Our role, from what I can see so far, has been to pay attention to various aspects of the Instrumentum Laboris, which was, in a sense, the document to which all the bishops were invited to respond, and maybe to see how certain difficulties and tensions could be teased out. So, for example, I was asked to keep an eye on the need to clearly protect the distinctiveness of the ordained ministry and the irreplaceability of sacerdotal ministry, its uniqueness, and while at the same time look at the issue of how can the work of lay people in the church be better supported and acknowledged and recognised. In particular, there was a call from a number of Synod Fathers for the establishment of the ministry of catechist as a stable ministry in the church. That came from a number of different particular churches. So that there is a possible tension there, and I was asked to, in particular, to keep an eye on that one and summarise, in a sense, what was being said by the Synod Fathers in regard to that.
You've been handed the hot potato. Has it been difficult?
One hot potato. There are several. No, I mean, at this stage, our role is really one of synthesis. It's not to necessarily come down on one side or the other. To me, the issue to be looked at there is that ordained ministry is a sacrament. It's a sacramental ministry. It's a representative ministry that shares in the headship of Christ. And I think the stronger our sense of sacramental ministry, the better able we'll be to see the other kinds of service that can be provided. And we won't see these as in threat to one another, but rather as complementary services to the body of Christ.
In fact, because in the first week we had many calls for a greater emphasis put on the role of women in the church. We even had the Archbishop of Brussels, I believe, Archbishop Léonard, speak of the fact that we have to clearly explain why the Catholic Church doesn't agree or believe in women priests. Not just say, no, it's not for us, but explain why. And then perhaps look at where we do need to enhance the role of women in the church. If there's been one criticism of the synod, it has been of the small representation of the female voice within the synod itself.
Well, first of all, that's exactly the point I was making. In a sense, Archbishop Léonard very clearly called our attention to the sacramental nature of ordained priesthood, and that is, in fact, the root of the issue with regard to the maleness of priesthood as we have it. But you're absolutely right. A number of bishops have very clearly talked about the women being the spine, the backbone of the church. And I think we know that for many of our churches, that, in fact, the faith is carried by women.
But not in governance. Was that the point that was being made?
Not in governance, but in terms of the daily life of the church, and there have been a series of calls for that to be recognised more fully. I suppose the only thing I would say is that I understand that this may be small consolation to some, but that in fact more women than ever have been appointed to this synod in one capacity or another, be that as experts, and there are a number of women among the experts, or as they call them, auditors, people who are there to listen, but also in fact to speak from their own particular perspective as well.
Now let's look at your particular history of why you were called as an expert to this synod. You come from Limerick. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the Irish geography, Limerick is, of course, on the western seaboard. It's a diocese in itself, but at the same time, it's a city. It's a very populous city on the western seaboard, one that has been very badly struck by the economic crisis. It has always had a very deep and rich Catholic tradition, but nonetheless, it has been affected by secularism. This is something that you took on yourself to try and confront, to face, and to try and help the faith reach out to the people of today, starting with this city.
Well, I suppose I work in a small theology department in a liberal arts faculty of what is in fact the largest Catholic college in Ireland, College of Education and the Liberal Arts, called Mary Meckler College. But because we're a small department, we don't have the luxury perhaps of being very specialised. I have taken a keen interest in the whole area of faith and culture over the last number of years. And I suppose anything that affects the lived experience and the life of the Christian community is of interest to me. People ask me, you know, what kind of theologian are you, systematic or fundamental or moral? I say pragmatic. Pragmatic theology in the sense of trying to respond out of the depth of the tradition of the church to the issues that confront us in our daily lives. And I say including myself. It's a dialogue that goes on in my own heart as much as I see it around me in the lives of others. You're absolutely right. The Irish church is in a I suppose, a very challenging situation, and I have found myself saying, in a sense of almost reflecting on what gift at this, you know, time of great woundedness in the Irish Church can we bring to the Synod. Perhaps it's the experience of being liberated from any sense of pride or reputation. We are in the ashes, but you know, there's a liberation that comes from being in the ashes, where all you can stand up for and rely upon, in fact, is the gospel, is the power of the good news, is the power of the cross, and indeed the resurrection. And there's a certain liberation in that. We don't have anything anymore to hide. It's all out there. All the dirty linen is hanging from the clotheslines. There may be more of the same, but we know where we stand, and we know the fragility of the standing of the Catholic Church in Ireland. And we have to now find a voice that is courageous and confident, yet utterly respectful of the pain that has been caused in the past, and learning from that, that we speak with humility, with honesty, with humility, with sincerity, but also with courage and confidence, which isn't because of any pride on our part, but because we really do believe in the good news.
You call yourself a pragmatic theologian. You're also a past president of the European Theological Society, if I'm not mistaken. But sometimes people, when they hear the word theology, ideology, they just automatically switch off, particularly the younger generation. I would think of my own age group. How do we translate the theology of evangelization or the theology to a very practical level that is accessible to people who don't have that theological preparation? Therefore, when they read these interventions, when they read things such as the Instrumentum Laboris or the guidelines, they really don't understand. How are we going to go about putting it into practice?
Well, first of all, I think it is put into practice. I'm a little uncomfortable with this attempt to, not by you, but it has even voiced itself here in the Synod, to somehow say that, well, the pastoral realities and the theological insights are somehow in tension or with one another. If it is, it's a creative and a very important tension. I think it was Karl Rahner said somewhere that there's nothing as practical as a good theory. And if we don't have good, in fact, I think part of what we're dealing with in the Universal Church is where at times pastoral practices were put into place that did not have solid theological underpinning. So there has to be always this creative interaction between theology and practice. And of course, that means that there shouldn't be theologians in the church whose own lives are so removed from pastoral realities that they're in a sort of a self-referencing little circle. And similarly, there shouldn't be pastors whose daily ministry and daily practice is not grounded in theological reflection. And I think that's the key, is that those, in a sense, it's not a case of one reality determining the other, but it's, I think, the Venerable Bede talked about the church begetting the church. And I think that's the task of theology, and indeed of pastoral theology, that we give birth to the new experience in continuity with the lived tradition in the circumstances of our everyday. And that's exactly the tone that was set by Vatican II, which in a sense we're also commemorating in these days. It was a pastoral council. And I actually felt at the very start of the Synod here, though the words mightn't have been used or the comparison made, there was a strong plea from Cardinal Wuerl in his introduction, his relatio, that this should in a sense be a pastoral synod.
One of the things that has struck me about this synod has very much been the fact that the secular media has picked on the fact that the church is divided between traditionalists and progressivists. Do you feel inside that synod hall that there really is such a net division of the church? Do you think it's an easy stereotype, basically?
Well, the first thing is that, the reality is that we have to engage with the secular media. Mm-hmm. They often tell the truth, but they don't tell the whole truth. And I think that's part of the problem. So what they say may be true, but it may not be given in its entirety or in its context. Certainly, what I'm experiencing here is a unity, but as I said earlier, it's not a uniformity. it allows for difference. But, you know, we're united, I think, in the... First of all, united in faith. At times, maybe our faith is fragile, but we're united in the faith we have. It's very interesting that every session begins with prayer and ends with prayer. And I think that's hugely important. And I think the first thing I would challenge people who see themselves as right or see themselves as left or whatever, are you willing to pray together? If you're willing to pray together, then you can work together. And I think that's, you know, that's the strength of the Catholic Church. We're not a sect. A sect seeks to surround itself with only like-minded people. The great thing about the Catholic Church is that we genuinely need the sign of peace, which we offer to one another on a Sunday morning. And you don't choose who you sit beside, or at least you shouldn't choose. This is what it means to be part of a community rather than a sect. And that's, I think, we always must struggle to be patient with one another, to be willing to learn from one another, to respect the pluriformity of expressions of faith within that greater unity, and strive for that. And I think more and more people are coming around to that recognition. I hope it's not just a unity over against, because we see the forces of secularism or other religions or whatever else. I hope it's a sense of a unity around the mystery, which none of us fully grasps, but we're all subject to.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
All right. Is that all right?